Good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 043837, Gregory Tauber against Graco Children's Products Incorporated. Mr. Kehoe.
Your Honors, good morning. The case that we'll talk about first thing this morning involves the allegation of three errors occurring either at trial or at the summary judgment level, which we believe each in its own right would justify the case going back for retrial. The first issue that I would like to address with you we call the recall issue, which is outlined in the brief, and it has to do with the CPSC position establishing a defect in the product, the company jointly going along with and making a decision to recall, and it's Exhibit 112 in the appendix. It's our position, Your Honors, that the recall, and importantly, coupled with Mr. Galambo's 30B6 designee witness testimony, characterizing the recall and the CPSC finding as joint, constitutes an 801D admission. It is a declaration that would, on its face, by a finder of fact, be viewed as contrary to their interest. We think that it was proper to have this evidence not only before the finder of fact, but to be addressed as part of the plaintiff's expert witness testimony, which in this case would be Mr. Johnson.
Now, that letter did not require a response from Graco, did it?
The letter did not require a response, but Graco was afforded by regulations an opportunity to comment. They were afforded an opportunity to oppose. They did not, as their company 30B6 designee said. They concurred. They offered no adverse comment, and they jointly participated in the recall decision.
There was also quite a bit of other evidence, though, at the trial, was there not, that the recall had occurred? I mean, this was not something the jury was unaware of.
I think there was some reference to the recall. What there was not reference to, which is most important to the plaintiff's case, is that the company indeed jointly agreed to the recall. And again, it's that binding testimony on the part of the company that is so relevant, because that is in direct opposition to the very position they took on this issue through all of their witnesses, who said, you know, not only was there no defect, but you know, the modification that was suggested created new hazards.
But the heart of that letter dealt with misuse of the product, didn't it?
The heart of the letter
talked about the fact that there was a great potential of misuse.
Well, there
and
was,
didn't really make a specific finding that the product was defective.
No, I don't agree with that characterization. I think the first paragraph of the letter indeed addresses the defect issue, and I think the regulation itself identifies what is required for the commission to make a finding that there is a defect, that there is an unreasonable risk of harm, which they found in this case. And the defect and the harm was one that brought about strangulation. And they mentioned strangulation in the letter, and this is the very issue, the very eventuality that took the life of Trevor Tauber.
Right, because they said if the harness restraint straps are loose or unbuckled, a child may become entangled.
Which, of course, is foreseeable. We know because there had been strangulations, injuries, and deaths that predated the death of Trevor Tauber. We think...
But you know, this letter in and of itself, Exhibit 112, which is at A83 of the appendix you filed, is this interim letter. It's from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, You're trying to use this letter along with the testimony to create this admission, but I'm not sure you can get that far. We know that the consumer product safety, or the jury knew, without Mr. Galambos or without anybody, that the commission was taking a look at it, and it's the staff of the commission that made the preliminary determination, not the company.
And the company joined and agreed that they were on notice of prior strangulations, and they agreed and did not challenge the finding that there was an unreasonable risk of harm, that being strangulation. It is that joint participation in joint issue that I think places a different light on the credibility of all of the evidence that Krayco would offer in this case, which flew in the face of every finding that the commission made that Krayco participated in.
I'm having difficulty. I understand the letter would have been sort of the icing on the cake, but the jury knew about the recall, and the jury could make certain inferences with respect to that, and they knew the basis of the recall, did they not?
I know.
That there was this potential of strangulation. That was evidence that you put in.
I know.
I'm trying to determine what the real harm was to not get this final piece when the jury knew about the recall. They knew the basis of the recall, true? That came out. That was put in.
There was reference
to Plaintiff's Exhibit 12, for example.
And I don't believe that was admitted into the record, Exhibit 12, for example. But the real thrust of the plaintiff's argument is the credibility factor of Krayco acknowledging a defect, making a joint decision to recall because of a strangulation hazard, and then coming into trial even after having prior strangulation, saying our product is not defective. We think that credibility has to be challenged when their expert takes a diametrically opposite position and totally says, I don't care what the commission did. I don't even want to consider that. I think that is casting a credibility pall over the entirety of Krayco's evidence that they put before the court. We really don't think, Your Honors, that this is much different than the issues presented in Trailer, for example, the opinion penned by Judge Posner, that says this type of evidence has to come in if it occurs after the sale and before a death. And the other case that we think is directly on point is Murray, a case in which Your Honor participated
in. Murray, of course, the Secretary of the Veterans Affairs said Mr. Murray died because of negligence at a Veterans Administration hospital in the press release. That's how his wife found out. And it's a much more direct statement than this ongoing investigation by the CPSC and trying to pin their conclusions on the company.
Our position is when the commission makes a finding of an unreasonable risk of harm and the company does nothing to oppose it and instead jointly participates in adopting that position that it is indeed an 801D adoption.
Well, all I'm saying
is
a step removed. I understand that's your position, but it definitely is a step removed from the Murray situation where the party who is being bound by the statement is the defendant itself. They're the United States through the secretary. So, and it was only an evidentiary admission, actually not a judicial admission. But yeah.
I think it's a very small step. And, even in Murray, nobody said that statement was dispositive.
Right.
Nobody
right.
is saying here that the commission position and the company's adoption of that is binding. They're still free to challenge it. But to keep that evidence from the jury as to the corporate adoption of that, I think eviscerates the plaintiff's case and it unduly eliminates an opportunity to challenge the credibility of the defense evidence.
Of course, this credibility point was argued before the jury, that is. How could their, I assume it was, how could their expert take such a position and yet they agreed to a recall? I mean, that evidence came in that they did a recall. Wasn't that credibility point? I guess, was that argued during trial?
There was some argument. The evidence that didn't come in was the company's position and adoption.
Oh, I understand that, but I'm saying the issue of credibility came out. In other words, I'm sure there was an argument made that the expert is taking this position. On the other hand, ladies and gentlemen, they recalled the product. And so what does that mean here? That means you can't believe...
And it's the circumstances of the recall that were never fleshed out for the jury, because to use Judge McKinney's own words, we are not going to be talking about recall. And yes, it came out in limited fashion, but it was never directly addressed, even though the motion in limine rulings were to the contrary. Plaintiffs prepared their case assuming this was going to be direct evidence, and indeed it was not. And we think that's enormously prejudicial, particularly when we have compliance with government agency regulations and standards that industry has a right to use and to create presumptions. Isn't the opposite side of that coin, that a CPSC finding in the company's reaction to that, isn't that evidence as well?
Of course, there's no case law that you can cite that supports your theory of this presumption that when you get notice from an entity like this means that that translates into an admission.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that in any way. It's the company action that translated into an admission, not just the fact that it was promulgated. But it's still the opposite side of the coin of industry using government regulations as indeed a presumption.
Mr. Kehoe, I know you're in your rebuttal time, and whether you want to on rebuttal or now, I wanted to explore a little bit your position on the jury instruction, because, of course, the evidentiary issue is a tough one given abuse of discretion standards of review, and as I understand, your argument on the jury instruction is more an argument on the law.
Yes. Clearly we feel like it was a shifting of the burden.
And what are we to do? Suppose we thought, as you suggest, that Indiana law is a bit murky on this point. Do you have an Indiana case that squarely addresses how one reconciles the 3422-1 elements and the defense in 3426-5?
The affirmative defense issue,
right, well,
and,
right,
and the timing
the
issue.
The problem is pretty much the same language. You know, the main statute says one of the things that's the element of the case is that the product is expected to and does reach the user or consumer without substantial alteration. And then you move around to the defense and say it's a defense to an action that a cause is a modification or alteration of the product, blah, blah, blah. I mean, yes. So you have these two components of Indiana law that need to be reconciled, and the district court judge follows the pattern instructions in the way he reconciles them. But I wondered if there's any Indiana case law that would help us assess whether the district judge did so correctly.
Well, I think the short answer to that is no. Other than I would ask the court to look at the argument of counsel, which we presented on page 17 of our reply brief, and look at that in light of the Schultz versus Ford case, which is a 2005 recent decision that talks about a counsel placing absolute emphasis on what would be an incorrect instruction, and the instruction which said it was the plaintiff's burden to show that there was not substantial alteration at the time that it reached Trevor, which of course we don't think is the statute, we don't think it's the law, and it isn't even making that issue an affirmative defense.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Krezer.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Krasovic. I represent Graco Children's Products. One point of clarification, I may refer to Century Products Company from time to time. They are the manufacturer of the product. Graco succeeded to their liability. That's why Graco is a party to this case. That's why you see in many of the documents the name Century. Let me address Exhibit 112 first and foremost, the October 23, 1997 letter. The panel is correct. The court, or the jury, heard substantial evidence with respect to the recall of this product. Judge McKinney ruled that the recall was admissible for purposes of determining whether there was a defect in the product and whether that defect was the proximate cause of the injuries claimed. With respect to this admission issue, the court really had need look no further than the terms of the letter itself. And I refer the court, the entirety of the letter is attached to plaintiff's appendix A83 through A86. If we look on page A86, which is page 4 of the letter, the Consumer Product Safety Commission is telling us in this letter itself that, quote, a firm's taking corrective action does not constitute admission by the firm that a substantial product hazard exists. That is the basis of the district court's ruling for denying that this is an admission. The CPSC itself said that the corrective action is not an admission, and for good reason, because it should be the policy that if a company desires to undertake a recall of its product, it shouldn't then automatically be deemed to have agreed with a finding that the product presents a substantial hazard. That would chill a company's desire and willingness to perform recalls.
In what way was the jury informed that Century, or if you will, Graco, whoever you want to call them, knew that 3 deaths and 1 near strangulation had occurred as of 1997? I'm looking at the press release from the CPSC, but whether it was through the press release or in any other way, how did the jury find out that this company knew long before Trevor was strangled that this had happened?
The jury knew in a couple of different ways. One is it knew from the testimony from witnesses that the product had been recalled and retrofitted with a new harness, a different harness configuration than the original harness.
So that strangulation would not occur.
Correct. That had been as a result of deaths that had occurred in the strangulation. And the jury heard specific evidence about the first death that had occurred in 1993 prior to when this swing was made about a child that had strangled in the harness. The jury heard about it that way. They heard about it through the testimony of witnesses. Quite frankly, I don't understand why Tober's trial counsel did not attempt to admit, I believe it's Exhibit 12, the press release.
Right.
It was never attempted to be moved into evidence. I think under the court's ruling, it could have been, but it never was. But in any event, this jury did hear about other deaths that had occurred in this swing with this harness posing a strangulation risk.
Now, I wonder if we could move to this instruction issue that I was starting to talk about with Mr. Kehoe. There does seem to be a real dearth of Indiana law to guide us through the way one reconciles these two provisions of the law that are awfully close to one another. And I just have to say, as a matter of logic, it would make sense to think that the principal statute, 2-1, is talking about the moment at which the user or consumer buys it and then the affirmative defense as of the time of the harm. I mean, it's very hard to make these not overlapping. And the district judge did stress the importance, as of course you would know, of burden of proof. What authority do you have for defending how the judge instructed on this point?
Well, I would refer the court to one case, and then I'll explain the reasoning that the district court followed, which I do think gives harmonizes both of those provisions and allows us to read them together without reading any language into them or out of them. The case that I'm referring to is Schooley, S-C-H-O-O-L-E-Y, versus Ingersoll Rand Incorporated. It's cited at 631 Northeastern 2nd, 932. It's an Indiana appellate court case, 1994, and I'll quote from that decision. It states, under Indiana law, a plaintiff can prevail under strict products liability theory only if he can demonstrate that the allegedly defective product reached him without substantial alteration in the condition in which it was sold and that his injuries were caused as a result of the defective product.
But here's where I want to pick that apart a little bit, because if all the plaintiff had to do was prove that at the time Ms. Fitzgerald acquired this swing, it hadn't been altered, you know, it hadn't fallen apart in the shipping box or whatever. And then it was your affirmative defense to cover the time period between her purchase and when Trevor winds up sitting in it. That would be a different case, as I understand it. The district court interprets the term "the user" here to mean Trevor, not to mean Ms. Fitzgerald. And, it, you know, one could go either way on that. I don't know that it's clear.
Well, let me make 2 points on that. One is, and I think we cited to the stipulation that's in the record, the Tobers asked for and we stipulated that for purposes of who the user and consumer is under the Indiana Product Liability Act, that user is Trevor Tober. So the parties stipulated that the user is Trevor Tober, not Ms. Fitzgerald.
So you think maybe that just stipulated away the whole defense? Because if you've got to go all the way up to the time that Trevor used it, then, you know, whether people are taking plastic slides off or all the rest gets subsumed.
Well, I think the way the statute works and the way that the district court interpreted the statute is this. The plaintiffs have a design defect claim. They don't claim that the product broke in some fashion or fell apart. They claim that the configuration of this harness, which are shoulder straps that come over the baby's chest and buckle down between the legs, is a defective configuration. It promotes strangulation. They state that the alternative design should have been a straps that go around the waist and through the crotch. That the determination of whether or not that product is defective occurs at the time that the product leaves the manufacturer's hands. The jury was asked those three questions. The third question being, was the product defective when it left the manufacturer's hands? And for the jury to have concluded that the product had a design defect, it would have had to conclude that as originally configured, the product was defective. So how does this come back to the statute? The way to read the statute is, the jury must look at from the time that the product was delivered until the time that the injury occurred, had it been substantially altered. Substantial is not in the affirmative defense section. That could mean had the harness been removed, had the design ceased to be what it originally was, did it no longer resemble in any way the original design that the manufacturer employed?
But that seems to me that all that stuff about whether it's knotted or anything is beside the point. It was still a shoulder harness, even
right,
as of the day Trevor
was
in it.
It still was a shoulder harness, and there were two straps that came down over his shoulders. And what the jury determined is that based on the evidence it heard from the designer of the product, from the experts in the case, that's not in and of itself a defective design. And they stopped there. That's why they answered no to the third question, and that ended their inquiry. If they concluded that, no, it was in its substantial condition, now the burden shifts to the defendant to say, well, it may have been substantially the same, but there was an alteration made that was the proximate cause of the injury and that was not reasonably expected by the manufacturer. That's the other provision in the affirmative defense that's not in 2.2-1 subpart 3. So that's how it works. If you don't have that, then the jury is left wondering, well, if it's a design defect case, where is it that I judge whether the design is originally defective?
But it seems to me there was a lot of talk about these alterations. Do you think that instructions were clear to the jury that the only thing they were focusing on for the plaintiff's burden of proof was that it was still a shoulder harness? I mean, it seems to me the jury might have been thinking it was supposed to think about all of these other issues as well.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, and if you look at the closing argument of the Tober's trial counsel, you'll see that what he did was walk through each of the instructions and each of the questions that the jury had to answer. And when he got to question 3, he told the jury the swing as originally configured, and in the courtroom, and we had admitted into evidence, a swing originally configured and then the swing the way it was configured on the morning that Trevor Tober used it. He said there was evidence submitted to show that as originally configured, the shoulder harness is defective. Then he went on to say, now, you have to decide whether it had been substantially altered. No, it had not been substantially altered. It was still basically a shoulder harness. He made those points to the jury. The jury heard evidence on it, and it rejected it because it didn't get off of the first point, which is, we don't think the shoulder harness to begin with was defective.
Did you make anything of the little tie in the front was
Yes.
gone as well?
It appears that the tie was used to form the knot that instead of the straps being routed through the swing seat as it should have been, they used a knot. Somebody used a knot to tie off to hold the length of the straps, because there's a slide back there that you can adjust it. Somebody used that tie to put a knot there to fix the length. And that was one thing that we were going to argue was an alteration or a modification that was a proximate cause, because once you did that, you could not adjust the length of the strap to be appropriate for a child. And as we know from the press releases, a loose belt was one of the problems identified as contributing to the strangulation hazard.
Right, but of course, if the plastic slide was the wrong place, the straps could have been too loose also.
True. I mean, and that may or may
have to actually go around to the back of the swing and pull before you did anything.
Correct.
Okay.
I see that my time is up. So.
Not late, actually.
Thank you, Mr. Krasovic.
On the material alteration, I think defense counsel's argument leaves out the critical issue of causation. And as instructed, specifically, it would have been the plaintiff's burden to show that there was no material alteration at the time that it reached Trevor. And that's not our burden. And that was emphasized specifically in defense counsel's argument, where he specifically says they must prove that it was expected and did reach Trevor without substantial alteration, and they cannot prove to you that's not the case. We think that's wrong, it's incorrect law, and it's enormously prejudicial. The emphasis that I would like to leave the court with is one that kind of combines the recall issue as well as the post-sale duty to warn issue. And that is the correct term, and it's not negligent recall as it's been mischaracterized. But if we look at Trailer, we look at Pfizer, you know, we look at Murray, and we look at is there a mea culpa issue with the recall notice 115. We think there is when we look at the 30B6 deposition testimony.
Now, let me just get back to the jury instruction for 1 minute. The instruction the court gave was a verbatim instruction from the Indiana pattern instructions. Is that right?
If there were changes,
they were minuscule.
They were minuscule.
All right.
I agree, and I think the critical point on the recall, as well as the post-sale negligence issue, is the company had 4 years. That is good policy to give them 4 years incentive to take action that they didn't do effectively, and we should have been able to challenge their motives as well as their actions, and we couldn't, and I think it left with a perverse result where your child could be, you know, the seventh strangulations, and no, they didn't know about other than one event, and that question was not addressed by defense.
Thank you, Mr. Kehoe.
Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel for their excellent arguments this morning. The case will be taken under advisement.